But, you know, with all the descriptions I've seen of the two of you, the two things I didn't see about the book, and you, I like the idea of it being a blueprint. It is a blueprint for people to survive, because it is hard to live. Mm-hmm. And it's certainly hard for poor people to live, and it's hard for people of color to live, and it's hard for people who are ostracized and who the society would attempt to dehumanize in order to justify their own contempt of folks. So it's a blueprint. It's a blueprint for growth, and it's a wonderful blueprint for the amalgam of culture. Culture is a total way people live their lives. The other thing that wasn't said about the two of you, which I knew before I read the book, you're remarkable intellectuals. You really are extraordinarily bright and articulate people. There's an intellectuality about the book, and you folks are, and perhaps that's why everything you do from the, you know, you were talking about Shalom Aleichem and from the raising of the sun and all these things, and they exude an intellectual sense, a way of analyzing and understanding the world that you live in. Mm-hmm. And you help other people understand the world they live in. And that's a remarkable contribution to give to people, aside from all the other contributions that you've made.
The people who have all the money, you know, have it, have access to everything, as against the people who do all the work. We have to see to it that knowledge is available and shared equally with everybody. And that is the intellectual responsibility. Not to be cute, not to show off, you know, but to share understanding, you know, among all of those who have a hunger and a need to know.
And that, in a sense, is love, you know, because when you really love somebody, you couldn't abide children starving. There's no way, and where I can make more money than a whole nation of people who are getting their food out of garbage pails, you know. Love must dictate that we share the world's resources. Economics, it must inform all these things we do.
But now, there was a time when we couldn't share the world's resources with great facility, because there was always more mouths to feed than there was food to put in the mouths. Mm. And those in control of the world took advantage of that fact to establish themselves as the elite, the one who had all the power, the one who controlled the means of production and whatnot. But with the introduction of the Industrial Revolution and the science and technology into our lives, we literally now can afford without effort to feed every mouth in the world. The intellectual is supposed to understand that and make that truth available to those who still believe that the world of scarcity and its laws still pertain. So we need to tell the world, that was yesterday when there was never enough to eat to go around. Today what we suffer from is having too much. To tell that knowledge to the world, to the workers of the world, enable them to say, hey, we can change this. We can create a society and an economy and a culture where the tremendous capacity to produce goods will be used. We'll produce goods for use rather than goods for commodity and for sale.
Because we all came from that time when people, that's what people were talking about. We weren't so far from when you know, don't forget, we came just in the Roosevelt years when all kinds of social problems, projects were being developed to keep people from starving to death. You know, and work was, there was work. And now we come to another place where I'm waiting for the other shoe to fall. Whenever I read of another 10,000, 100,000 people being laid off by this corporation so that the CEOs can make more money and they can have a bigger bonus and they don't can cut costs and get rid of the people, it worries me. We're calling down another kind of poverty on ourselves. This poverty of irrational accumulation. You know, and turning us all into another kind of slavery. You know, it's coming.
And look at the theater as a university or
beautiful
as a teaching
people, yeah.
institute as far as Ruby and Asa are concerned. One play in particular exemplifies the change in us, the growth in us that was offered by the theater itself, a play called The World of Sholem Aleichem. Mm-hmm. And it featured Howard De Silva mm-hmm. as one of the actors, Maurice Karnofsky is one of the actors, Arnold Pearl is the writer, Phoebe Brand, and several others. Our association with them introduced us to their concept of theater, which was totally different from what we had thought. Mm-hmm. The theater as an expression of the people's culture, a theater as an exemplar of working people with their crafts and their arts mm-hmm. being ennobled and being made important, came into our lives. Mm-hmm. And we never backed away from that. You know, entertainment, yes, but theater as an intensifier of the struggle itself, mm-hmm. you know, was made possible to us because these people had that point of view and they shared it
yes,
with us.
You know, but also, but still, I know, I don't know if we said this in the book, but I feel a terrible fury with Hollywood, with the top echelon of entertainment, because I look up and I think about Hollywood, there's a slogan that comes to my head, the USA made in Hollywood, you know. I think of that. The marvelous things we've reckoned with, but the horror of the images that by which we're now governed, and what a terrible responsibility those who feed our children's stuff into our children's heads, what some of those images have done. It's like drinking poison, putting poison into your body without balancing it with something else. There's a fury I feel with this power that it hasn't done nearly enough, and it's done too little of trying to be about what the divine intention. and blaming those who are victimized. One example, you know, we're kids with guns today. You know, it's nothing. It's nothing. It's parents, and we're beating up on parents. When I think of the terrible guilt of the arts and complicity in the degradation of our children and our society, there's a fury that I'm just praying. To God to help me to understand, and what can we do while we're here to help make it better, for all of the, because we've seen how it could be better. So anyway, with that, because it's cumulative. Oh, this made money, you know. So why not do it 10 times more? Don't do films that threaten to be uplifting or something like that. I'm trying to reckon and deal with all that, with all the people I love. In the arts and in the business aspect of it, there's still this I don't understand, because what we watch and what we see, what goes into our minds as much as what we are, what we put into our bodies.
I wanted to ask you, there was an article in the Times last weekend actually about reassessing the McCarthy period.
Yes.
And I noticed that you sort of talked about World War II and the hope
yes.
of that period, and then stopped at the McCarthy period.
Mm-hmm.
What happened during the McCarthy period as far as you were concerned, mm-hmm. to your work, to your friends?
Mm-hmm. Well, there were certain impulses and things that were happening in the communities of which I'm a member, the black community is one, the labor community is another, mm-hmm. and the theatrical community, of which I thought we were proud. You know, we'd helped to establish the United Nations, and we were looking forward to the end of colonialism, and we were looking forward to the realization of the kind of world that Roosevelt had promised us in 1944, where everybody would have a job and all of that stuff. And when those things were not forthcoming, you know, we began to raise questions and to make nuisances of ourselves. When when Churchill came and went to Fulton, Missouri, I think it was, and announced the Iron Curtain, and there was, instead of the camaraderie that we had felt between the American GIs and the Russian soldiers, you know, that ended World War II, all of a sudden you had a Cold War. But once again, we were confronting each other, and this time confronting each other with one of us having a bomb that could destroy civilization. We felt that our voices were beginning to be challenged, our right to speak were beginning to be challenged, and little by little we were demonized, and little by little we were made ineffective, and all of our creative energies had to be spent, you know, just defending ourselves or defending our rights to speak. We never really recovered from that as an artistic community, and that's one of the reasons why Hollywood and Broadway slipped imperceptibly toward the exposition of stuff that had no intellectual content whatsoever, because that way McCarthy certainly wouldn't bother you. But when we saw the people we loved shut down, a man like Robeson, for example, yeah. You know, we closed off the avenues for earning a living in America, and then the State Department took his passport so he couldn't earn a living overseas. But those of us in the black community, you know, we saw the connection. We knew what was going on, and we knew what that signal and what that meant. And we spent, what, about 8 years just trying to get Paul his passport back.
So many.
And
people died, killed themselves.
And we saw people like Lumumba killed, and people like Arbenz in Guatemala destroyed, and people like Mossadegh in Iran, you know, being put down. You know,
a whole lot of theater people, John Henry Falk in Canada.
And all of these great forces that were determining the coloration of the world experience were under attack and under assault. And those of us who tried to show support either to them or to their ideals, we were also under attack and under assault.
Well, also, you know, the unique thing about that, and I know we've been at this, is the fact that it affected us in a strange way. Because although I understand we were on some lists, and I was in Ed, and I made a speech in favor of not killing the Rosenbergs, you know, because for so many reasons, because very many of our supporters in the early civil rights movements were white, were Jews, were people who were against lynching and the brutality and the poll tax and all that. All these struggles was a coalition going on there that was admirable. So when I was asked to speak for the Rosenbergs, we couldn't think about hesitating to say, oh no, these people must not be executed and so forth. It was a ridiculous thing. But to hear people say, oh, they'll put you out of Hollywood. You won't be able to earn any. You won't be able to get a job. Well, Ossie and I, we shouldn't say this, but we went sort of like howl, because we never felt that even remotely touched us. We didn't belong to those. We didn't belong to that crowd where it could even touch us. And we would say, I never will forget, well, how can you see a little bit of red and so much black, you know? It was a strange time for us, but we felt a confidence. We worked more. We met people that we never would have met. Those people have been forced out of Hollywood. It was a marvelously important time for us. So we were affected.
There was also another way in our response that set us aside.
Yeah.
We as black people, you know, expected to be kicked. We expected to be lynched. Mm-hmm. We didn't welcome it, but that was what was happening to black folks, you know. If we didn't get the job, we knew why, you know, it wasn't unusual. So along come this bright, brilliant group of people who, for one moment, on top of the world, and now they too are getting kicked, and they too are getting upset. And to them, it's their world's crumbling. But to us, it wasn't, because we never had that world. So Ruby and I and some others, we went through the McCarthyite period, you know, and we suffered it, but we also laughed at it. Because we said to our friends, oh, you didn't know this was happening. You should have been black for a while, and you would have been prepared, you know. So there was a kind of humorous overtone to all our response, and even to this day, the McCarthy, the punishment they gave us, you know, was limited in our own minds because we never took it quite as seriously, maybe as we should have.
You were on this list and you were on this book, and it was the most incredible thing, you know. But there were blacks who were deeply affected, who lost, you know, work. I think about Canada. I think about many people who were making lots of money and that sort of thing. But we had found a way to make a living, independent of Hollywood and Broadway and stuff. So we.
Let's not pontificate any further. Okay. Talk to me about the book. What do you
think? Ossie, Isn't It the Truth?
Yes. Marvelous. It Ossie Ossie and Ruby in this life together.
I hope you
it's
can,
so yummy. I'm going to run out and buy a copy right now. You know, find out what it's all about.
Please.
So, what do you think about the book? What's your response?
A great relief that we finished it. And that it's finally being sold.
But you think that all that effort was worthwhile?
Yes, I do.
All that blood on
and
the
just
floor.
Just to hear the kids say, "Mom, why didn't you tell us so and so and so?" And the deep pain that I didn't ask my children, that my parents, to tell me. I bought my mother a tape recorder, but I didn't teach her how to really use it. That's a source of deep pain to me that I didn't get. I didn't get from my parents, and I'm hoping that this will teach them to give to their children, so that. Because we need that sense of continuity. We need a flow from each other, you know, so that we don't feel that we just start from scratch.
Well,
hop out the womb and start from scratch.
What about those areas where we disagree on what we saw?
But that's okay.
There were things I described vividly.
Yes.
And you look at them and say, it wasn't that way at all.
That's right.
How do we resolve that?
Well, I'm hoping that they understand that there's such a difference between the male mind and the female mind. And the female needs a great deal of patience. And also to, you know, and when she... You learn how to suffer and agitate creatively.
There was never in our lives, as I remember, a major point of difference on a major issue. What we might have differed on, as we remembered, was some detail that you saw that I'd forgotten, or some detail that I saw that you forgot, or some incidents that I remembered that you've totally put out of your mind, I think, or vice versa.
Maybe so.
Yeah.
And also, he's a very nonviolent person, and so...
Which means I'm a coward, huh?
No, that's not... He's
I would
just
accept
not a,
that.
But it's a good thing that I'm not very large in stature, because I probably would have annihilated him by now. And he'd be speaking to me from a jail cell or something. But because I'm far from... I had to teach myself, you know, it's like, you know, how short people can get to be such bullies.
But women have to express themselves. And you have some wonderful, wonderful passages about women. I love the little interchange there when you decided to take an acting class after the arrival of the baby.
Yes.
And Ozzy suddenly says... But of course, if that's all you had wanted to begin with, oh, sure, as though you hadn't had to convince him of that.
Yes, exactly. But one thing.
Oh, is that exactly, or am I just creating dissent here?
But there was one lucky thing that I encountered, and that is the fact that he was a very, he's a good pupil. He was sensitive, and he wanted to. I really could alert him to things, and he was. Some things that he did, he really didn't know any better. He was the first grandchild. He was the first nephew. He was one of the first boy in his family. He was adored. And he has a great disposition, a sense of humor. So he really didn't have, he doesn't come through, you know, these difficult, rough, emotional things. So I don't know. What was I saying all that about?
I wonder.
But what I mean to say is that was so he was why he was eager for and this was pre feminism, you know what I'm saying? And so we the feminist movement. So the things that rattled me, I was just wrestling with stuff that I wasn't quite sure of. So we had to go through that together rather than the movement in the atmosphere hadn't struck yet.
Let me ask you one final question, okay, which would close this whole session out.
All right.
If the whole thing was presented to us again, mm-hmm, and I dashed into your life and proposed that on a Thursday you and I take the train to New Jersey and get married, would you do it again?
Ossie, don't ask me those kinds of questions. Suppose I said...
You're not under oath, you know. You always lie. You can tell me. Make me feel good. Say
yes.
Oh, my
goodness.
Say yes, Ruby. Don't hurt my feelings.
I'll say yes. Okay. I'll say more than yes. There's some things that happen out beyond your... And I think I was lucky in that respect. I think we really did come together from someplace else to finish something.
Ossie Davis and Ruby Dee, you are entirely too gracious. Maybe we can just round it out. What's the next project? As you approach your 50th wedding anniversary.
Yes.
We're
going to have a big blowout, you know.
Speak to us about it.
We're going to the Grand Hyatt on 42nd Street in New York on December the 15th. Our anniversary is on the 9th. We're having this party on the 15th. It's going to benefit 12 theaters based in New York, the kind where both of us met in theaters. Me and from the American Negro Theater, Ossie from the Rose McClendon Players, and we're going to benefit these places, and we hope people will come. And that's what we're working on right now. And we have, of course, we both have a couple movies coming out, things like that.
Well, tell us a little bit about the movies that are coming up. Get some advance publicity over here.
Well, I just finished one last week. One of them is called...
The Passing Game.
Passing Glory. It's about basketball. And then we've been doing some Promised Lands together that are coming out. One tonight, as a matter of fact. Oh, Ossie, we won't be seeing it.
How lucky we are.
Oh, Ossie's
on. All right, okay.
And we have a couple of films... in the wings that we're about to embark on, but I don't want to talk about those.
Ruby, last year did a stint at Hunter, called My One Good Nerve, based on her works, which was very well received. Mm-hmm. And as soon as we get this thing put to bed, we're going to go back in motion, probably go to Los Angeles and go across the country. I myself am finishing a play I started about 37 years ago for Ruby, and hopefully I'll present it to her before the year's out.
And that it won't wind up that he's going to be the star of it.
Not this time. You got more. No, you can.
Well, dear friends, thank you, because one thing about the book and everything else you've done, we can't afford to ever lose you folks, and. You've given us a lot, and there's a lot to preserve, and so everybody's got to go out and read it and keep something that's quite sacred, including the small drops of blood, sweat, and toil that we'll put into the effort.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
And that's all for this edition of Building Bridges, your community and labor report.
Building Bridges was produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
To contact Building Bridges, you can email us at mer@legal-aid.org.